Welcome to this December 2025 review from the Journal of the American Academy of Dermatology. Four pieces caught my eye this month: a simulation study out of Italy, rethinking how we triage melanoma excisions; a transplant dermatology case series on sirolimus and non-melanoma skin cancer; a digital epidemiology study, tracking public interest in tanning beds; and a sharp letter to the editor on a pitfall in dysplastic nevus margin reporting that's directly relevant to how we counsel patients. Let's get into it. First up is a brief report out of the province of Trento, Italy, a prospective cohort study paired with a simulation model, looking at how to prioritize melanoma excisions and secondary care. The background here is worth sitting with. Essentially, all of the diagnostic delay literature in melanoma focuses on primary care delays, time to presentation, time to referral, and almost nobody has looked rigorously at the bottleneck that happens once a patient is already in a dermatology surgical queue. In Trento, dermatologists have been using a simple binary urgency code, urgent versus non-urgent, to decide who gets excised first. The question this group asked is whether that judgment-based system actually works, and whether folding in additional patient variables could do better. Methodologically, they prospectively collected 301 excised lesions over 6 months, capturing the assigned urgency code alongside age, sex, nevus count, and prior melanoma history. They ran a logistic regression to see which of these variables actually predicted a histologically confirmed melanoma. Then, and this is the more novel piece, they built a Monte Carlo simulation testing 24 different prioritization strategies across a range of surgical slot availabilities, from 35 slots up to 150, running each scenario 10,000 times to get stable estimates. The logic for choosing simulation over, say, a prospective trial of alternate triage systems is fairly obvious once you think about it. You cannot ethically or practically randomize real patients to a worse triage algorithm to see how many melanomas you miss. Simulating detection rates against a known, already collected cohort lets you stress test competing prioritization rules against the real distribution of disease without touching patient care. That's my read on the rationale. The authors don't spell it out explicitly, but it's the standard justification for this kind of in silico approach. The results were fairly clean. Both age and the dermatologist's urgency code were independent predictors of melanoma on regression. Each additional year of age bumped the odds up modestly, but urgent code status increased the odds more than fivefold, which tells you the existing gestalt-based triage isn't worthless. It's just incomplete. The simulation confirmed this. At a baseline of 77 available slots, a combined age and urgency weighted strategy detected about 35 melanomas, compared to 24 with urgency only prioritization, and only 9 with no prioritization at all. Even when they choked the system down to just 35 slots, a genuinely resource constrained scenario, the composite strategy still caught 20 melanomas versus only 4 with no prioritization. And the advantage held up as they scaled capacity all the way to 150 slots, so this isn't just a small numbers artifact. The authors are appropriately modest in the discussion. This is single center, Trento specific, over just 6 months. So there's no way to speak to long-term outcomes, like mortality or recurrence. The simulation predicts detection efficiency, not survival benefit, though obviously earlier detection is the whole game in melanoma prognosis. They're upfront that real-world barriers exist too. Clinicians may resist deprioritizing a lesion they've already decided to cut. There are medical-legal optics to formalizing an age-based deprioritization scheme, and you'd need staff retraining to implement it. Practically, I'd call this interesting and directionally practice-informing, rather than immediately practice-changing for most of us doing our own scheduling. But if you're in a system with real excision queues and waitlists, especially in the UK-style or European public health model, this is a genuinely actionable framework. Age-weighting your triage on top of clinical gestalt costs you nothing, and the simulated yield increase is substantial. Next, a case series with a strong translational message: sirolimus and its protective effect against non-melanoma skin cancer in kidney transplant recipients out of University of Wisconsin. You all know the background cold. Solid organ transplant recipients carry something like a 65 to 250-fold increased risk of non-melanoma skin cancer. Calcineurin inhibitors like tacrolimus compound that risk by further crippling tumor immunosurveillance. And the Tumorapa trial already showed that switching to sirolimus, a mammalian target of rapamycin inhibitor with intrinsic anti-tumor activity, cuts squamous cell carcinoma rates with benefits sustained out to 5 years. What this paper adds is a much longer look back, a retrospective case series of 214 adult kidney transplant recipients on sirolimus between 2003 and 2023, essentially asking whether that protective signal holds up over decades rather than years. The design choice here is straightforward and appropriate. This is a question about rarish long-term events across a large transplant registry, so retrospective cohort analysis is really the only feasible design. You're not randomizing transplant patients to carcinogenic immunosuppression to prove a point. They classified biopsy-confirmed squamous cell and basal cell cancers, attributed cancers occurring more than 2 years after sirolimus initiation to sirolimus and earlier ones to tacrolimus, and modeled incidence with negative binomial regression, adjusted for age and sex. Negative binomial being the right tool here because tumor counts are overdispersed count data, not a simple yes-no outcome. The magnitude of effect is the headline. Age and sex-adjusted tumor incidence was roughly 0.4 tumors per 12 treatment months on sirolimus versus around 4.3 on tacrolimus. That computes to something over a 90% reduction in overall tumor burden, and the effect was consistent whether you looked at squamous cell or basal cell histology specifically, with squamous cell showing the more pronounced drop. Male sex carried more than double the tumor risk relative to female, and there was a nonlinear age effect with tumor rates peaking around age 58 at transplant. Follow-up in this cohort stretched out remarkably far, up to 26 years for some patients, which is really the value add over Tumoropa's 5-year data. Limitations are the expected ones for a retrospective single-institution series. No randomization, so residual confounding around who gets switched to sirolimus versus who stays on tacrolimus is a real concern. And the authors flag that future work needs to look at combination regimens, since calcineurin inhibitors and mTOR inhibitors are increasingly used together for synergistic immunosuppressive and anti-tumor effect rather than as an either-or choice. For practical purposes, I'd call this practice-affirming rather than practice-changing. It doesn't overturn anything, but it substantially strengthens the case for proactively raising a sirolimus conversion with the transplant team in any patient you're seeing with recurrent or high-volume squamous cell carcinoma, particularly if they're male and in that 5th to 7th decade risk window. Third, a digital epidemiology study, a nice change of pace methodologically, looking at Google search behavior for tanning beds before and after the World Health Organization's 2009 reclassification of ultraviolet radiation from tanning devices as a Group 1 human carcinogen. Background: that reclassification was backed by a meta-analysis showing roughly a 75% increase in melanoma risk with tanning bed use before age 35. And we know indoor tanning has broadly declined nationally since, though frequent use persists in certain subgroups. This study asks a more granular question: did public interest actually shift measurably around that reclassification, and does it vary meaningfully by state? Methodologically, they used Google Trends relative search volume for the term tanning beds, chosen because it consistently had the highest relative search volume among related terms, pulling monthly data from 2004 through late 2024 and comparing pre- and post-reclassification averages with linear regression and Welch's t-tests, then correcting for testing across all 50 states using the Benjamini-Hochberg false discovery rate procedure. This is a reasonable design for what it is, a low-cost retrospective look at population-level interest trends, but it's worth being explicit with yourself that relative search volume is a proxy for curiosity, not a proxy for actual tanning bed use. Nationally, search interest declined significantly after the reclassification, though there wasn't a sharp inflection point right in 2009. The decline looks more gradual or delayed than a clean before and after stack change. After correcting for multiple comparisons, 18 states showed statistically significant shifts. Florida, Illinois, California, and Texas showed the largest declines, while Utah and Idaho actually showed significant increases in search interest. The author's interpretation is that state-level regulation, many of these states passed minor access bans or parental consent requirements. Several of them enacted after the WHO announcement, likely did more heavy lifting in shaping behavior than the international classification itself, while states like Utah and Idaho that still permit use with parental or physician consent didn't see the same drop. The honest limitations here are important. Google Trends measures interest, not behavior, so a decline in searches doesn't confirm a decline in actual tanning bed use, and the changes could just as easily reflect advertising shifts, media coverage, or unrelated public health campaigns rather than the WHO action specifically. There's also a seasonal signal, search peaks in spring and early summer, which the authors suggest is actionable for timing public health messaging. Overall, I'd file this as interesting but not clinically actionable in the sense of changing anything you do at the bedside. It's more useful as ammunition for supporting state-level tanning regulation advocacy and for timing patient education campaigns seasonally, rather than something that changes surgical or diagnostic practice. Last is a letter to the editor, a direct response to a previously published decision aid for patients with dysplastic nevi being considered for re-excision, and this one is squarely relevant to daily practice. The letter authors, from Mayo Clinic and University of Connecticut, praise the original patient decision aid, but push back on one specific line in it, the statement that a negative margin means no cells are left at the edge of the biopsy. Their point is that this is only true for the edges of the sections that actually get examined pathologically. It doesn't account for the well-documented possibility of a false negative margin on a punch or shave specimen. The teaching point, illustrated with a simple grossing diagram in the letter, is one every one of us already knows intuitively, but rarely says out loud to patients. Whether a biopsy margin reads as positive or negative depends heavily on how the specimen happens to be bisected during grossing, which dictates where the thin representative histologic sections are actually cut from. An oblong lesion bisected across its short axis, for instance, can easily miss nevi cells extending along the long axis, producing a falsely reassuring negative margin. Even a technically well-executed punch or shave, done with full intent to remove the lesion, may still miss the common subclinical trailing margin of a dysplastic nevi that extends beyond the visible clinical border. This isn't new data. They cite the existing literature on inadequate sampling in punch-excised melanocytic lesions and the known negative predictive value problem with dysplastic nevi margins. But the value of the letter is reframing this as a patient communication issue, not just a pathology methods footnote. Their proposed fix is simple and directly usable in your own consent conversations. A positive, especially inked margin generally does mean incomplete removal, but a negative margin on a punch or shave specimen does not reliably mean the nevi is gone. That asymmetry is exactly why re-excision can be reasonable, even in the face of a clear margin, particularly for severely atypical or dysplastic lesions, and it's a genuinely practice-relevant point, not because it changes what you do surgically, but because it gives you sharper, more honest language for explaining to patients why you're recommending re-excision despite a pathology report that reads as reassuring. That wraps our four pieces this month. A simulation model that makes a real case for age-weighted melanoma triage and constrained systems. Long-term real-world confirmation that sirolimus meaningfully protects transplant patients against non-melanoma skin cancer. A population-level look at how regulation, rather than global classification, seems to be driving tanning bed interest. And a sharp reminder from the letter section about the limits of a negative biopsy margin in dysplastic nevi. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next month.